Good afternoon to you. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today's Friday edition of A Juno Afternoon. And today we're going to get a preview of this week's Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center about Thomas Corwin Mendenhall, the man behind the name. We're going to talk to Kate Braidwood of the Wonderheads, who will be here performing next week in Juno. Tom Loker will be here to highlight this weekend's cabaret. We'll talk to Damon Stuber about his film Storis, the Galloping Ghost of Alaska's Coast. And we'll find out about the World Youth Day fundraiser with guest Winston Smith. That's all happening. Plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, more. All right here on Friday's edition of A Juno Afternoon. But first, National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. One of Alaska's largest tribal governments is pressing for an intensive environmental analysis of its home region's health. It's part of a larger push for protection of transboundary rivers, which flow from Canada's British Columbia into the region. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Leaders of Southeast Alaska's Tlingit-Haida Central Council want to document the condition of the region's waterways. They're concerned new mines operating or planned for BC watersheds could pollute those rivers that could threaten salmon and other traditional foods residents depend on. Council First Vice President Will Micklin says it's lobbying the Environmental Protection Agency and other federal offices to fund a three-year, $4 million effort.
We believe that there needs to be a sustained environmental analysis and data collection and modeling and the development of key indicators that determines what the environmental quality and health of the ecosystem exists in Southeast Alaska.
The council is also meeting with State Department officials. Second Vice President Rob Sanderson Jr. says it's about more than protecting salmon.
The most important part, I believe, is our way of life. Protecting everything from the fish to the smallest organism in the river.
British Columbia mine developers say they're building safeguards to protect regional watersheds. They say the tribe's concerns are not warranted. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
In this year's Iditarod race, four Alaska native dog mushers placed among the top 20. Emily Schwing reports.
In the last few years, Pete Kaiser has claimed victory in a number of shorter mid-distance sled dog races. This year, he took fifth place in the Iditarod. He credits his dog team.
Yeah, they did. They did good, and they look good, I think. We managed them right and got about the best possible performance we could have got, I think. So I'm happy with that.
Kaiser's team still seemed eager to race even after they crossed the finish line in Nome. This was his sixth consecutive Iditarod. He's placed in the top 10 twice, but not since 2012.
I was hoping to get back in the top 10 and then also, you know, kind of hoping for a top 5 too, and so I can live with this for sure.
Behind him were three Alaska Native mushers who placed in the top 20. 12th place, Richie Deal, bested his own fastest time by 12 hours. Former Iditarod champion John Baker placed 17th, and in 19th place was Ray Reddington Jr. I'm Emily Schwing in Nome.
The Navajo Nation welcomed Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders to the tribe's casino near Flagstaff, Arizona on Thursday. According to the Associated Press, Sanders' speech touched on Native American issues, including broken treaty promises, violence against women, and suicide. Sanders' visit comes before Arizona's primary next week. Sanders is vying for the Native American vote and has met with tribal leaders at campaign stops, including in Minnesota and Kansas. Meanwhile, the public premiere for the animated film Finding Nemo, dubbed in the Navajo language, begins today in select cities in the Southwest. The Disney Pixar movie is the second major motion picture to be dubbed in Navajo after Star Wars. Tribal leaders say it's part of language preservation efforts. Navajo Nation President Russell Begay has a small part in the film as the lobster. Begay says the movies and other language learning tools, such as smartphone technology, are helping people, including youth, learn the language or refresh their skills.
Navajo is my first language. I mean, I relearned it, and so I know anyone, if you were raised speaking Navajo, you can relearn that. It will come back. You just have to do it. You know, you just have to speak it. And then those that are second users, and there's so many opportunities these days.
Free screenings of Finding Nemo in Navajo are showing in theaters through next week on and off the reservation in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations to the Wise Pies Arena, a.k.a. The Pit, April 29th and 30th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome back to the KTO studios. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today's Juneau Afternoon. We're here for tonight. Mostly cloudy skies are in the forecast with lows around 30 degrees and cloudy with isolated rain showers in the afternoon. For tomorrow, I've been joined by Jim Garrity, who's a local historian that's going to be doing a talk out at the Fireside Lecture Series happening at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center tonight at 6:30. And, hey, Jim, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You have a fun topic of discussion because you're going to be talking in Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center about the man who that visitor center and that glacier was named after, and that's Thomas Corwin Mendenhall. Tell me a little bit about, just a brief bit about his life.
Well, he was a very influential man. He was raised, in rather poor circumstances, and he did take a brief bit of college to get a teacher's degree. But he just rocketed to the top of many different sciences, all on his own doing, all on his own education.
Completely self-taught, essentially.
Completely self-taught, wow. Yeah.
And ended up, the pinnacle of his career would have been when he was head of the USGS, is that right?
Well, there was that, but he also wrote extensively on electrical theory, a lot of which is still used today, a lot on gravitation, which is still used today. In many, many different disciplines.
Kind of a Renaissance man.
Very much so.
Type of person, yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
So he was a self-taught person, and then he becomes, tell me a little bit about the early life and how he ends up becoming head of the USGS.
Well, first of all, he was a teacher, and he did that extremely well, and he was a real proponent of experimentation and people taking their own initiative. And so when Ohio had a college, the first college there, he was actually selected to be the first professor at Ohio College. So he went from there, and everything that they asked him to do, he did exceedingly well. And so that usually gives you another rung on the ladder for the next project that somebody needs to tackle. And he was constantly interested in everything new that was going on.
And he has a wide variety, but can you just go through and name some of the areas that he worked on that he's still renowned for?
Well, he was an early adopter for the metric system, and one of the primary reasons why all scientific work is done in the metric system in America. He wrote a book on electrical theory. He did an enormous amount of work with gravitation and invented several things. He was in Japan and taught in Japan for some time and did a lot of work reporting back, on the changing economy and philosophy and stuff in Japan. He sometimes tilted at windmills like a lot of people do. And so he got in an enormous fight over the size of a stadium, and I think he lost that one. And then he famously wanted to close the School of Homeopathic Medicine, which he succeeded in doing.
Hmm. So then how did it come to be that the glacier was named after him?
Well, he was asked to become the head of the USGS, which is the United States Geological Survey. And so they were surveying all the coast of Alaska and triangulating points in Alaska, and so his crew of men were up here, and they were all doing surveying. They named hundreds and hundreds of points in Alaska, and this was one that was named.
So he was still alive when he was when the glacier was named after him?
Yes.
Oh, that's an interesting thing. I wonder if that's. Wonder how often that happens.
In those days, it happened very
often.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Someone would say, that's my glacier, and they would name it after themselves. Yeah, right. That sort of thing would happen. So, so he's studying this guy who has had all these different interests. Do you end up liking him? Does he have his foibles, too? Has he got his... As you said, he had his kind of maybe, like you said, tilted at windmills every now and then, had some
eccentricities. You know, nobody that well known doesn't have no enemies, you know.
Right.
But he was genuinely a good guy, and he wasn't the only one either. There was a number of people that you just don't hardly read a negative thing about them.
And you were saying that your work in historical research often centers around people who are almost unknown.
Yeah, so this is a little different for
me.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about maybe a few examples of that past work and how it was different.
Well, I mean, we're talking about a cruise the ship that came up here was called the Patterson. And here it was an official government vessel, registered and built for the government and very well known, thousands of photographs of it, and it was around for 54 years. And all the people on there were, government officials and extremely well known and documented. And the whole thing was budgeted by Congress. And a few years ago, I spoke on another ship that came here in 1868, the year after the Alaska Purchase, was called the Wyonda. And we don't have a single clear photograph of it, from broadside. It was only a few score years before Mendenhall was here, but the very, very different, the days of wooden ships and iron men, and the writing is much harder to translate than. The times and places were very obscure. There were no good maps. There were no good place names, and things like that. And spelling was, you'd have the same word spelled four different ways on one page.
Right.
So, of course, in a complete dearth of photos, there wasn't any photographer in 1868 in Alaska.
Right.
And then
you move to a subject where it's a man of kind of well known, he's pretty mm-hmm. renowned and very documented, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And was there anything that you uncovered about Mendenhall in your research that was a real surprise to you?
Oh, there were a few things. Yeah.
Can you think of one of them?
I can think of lots of them.
Yeah, well,
you're going to have to be at the presentation. Bill,
there you
tonight.
Go. I don't want to give away everything. Okay, all right. I get you. You don't want to give away too much. Yeah, well, we should mention it's the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center Fireside Lecture Series, and tonight it's on Thomas Corwin Mendenhall, the man behind the name. It's two presentations tonight, one's at 6:30 and then one's at 8 o'clock, and it's historian Jim Garrity that'll be there illuminating the life of this renowned scientist who was a superintendent of USGS, and then his name so prominently figures in Juneau life every day today.
Yeah, and came right here to Juneau in 1891.
Oh, okay. All mm-hmm. right. And then what was his lifespan? What years?
I think he died in 23, if I remember.
Oh, okay.
23 or 24.
Okay.
Yeah, so he lived a, very full life and... and very experienced, traveled worldwide and wrote a lot of his memoirs and stuff in France and places like that.
Oh, all right. Well, it's the man behind the name, Thomas Corwin Mendenhall. That's tonight, 6:30 and 8, Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center Fireside Lecture Series, and its historian, Jim Garrity. Jim, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great talk tonight.
By now, you should have somehow realized.
Welcome back to a Juneau Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and on the phone with you right now is from Wonderheads, Kate Braidwood. And Kate, what's your title there at Wonderheads? Are you chief head maker or?
I call myself co-head, which is a general term because I do many things for the company. I make the masks and perform and create the shows, so co-head kind of covers it all.
Well, you guys are performing Monday night at JDHS. It's happening at 7 p.m. Tickets are still available on the Juneau Arts and Humanities website, so that's at jahc.org, and people can go there. But tell me a little bit for folks who've never checked it out, and if you haven't, I would recommend going to wonderheads.com and seeing everything that Kate and the folks at Wonderheads do. Can you explain a little bit? I'm sure you've been asked this before. What is it? What can people sort of expect when they see your show?
Yeah, well, what we do is we work in this form that we call full face mask. So we have these large masks that cover our entire heads, and they're almost sort of cartoonish in nature. And we tell these stories. The shows are nonverbal. There are no words, but there's lots of sound and music in the shows. And it's kind of like watching a living cartoon. An audience member early on in our touring career said it was like watching live-action Pixar. And we're like, oh, that's good. That's a good way of describing it.
That's fun.
So
high,
it is. It's like that. Yeah, it's like
high compliment. Yeah.
yeah, totally.
Well, that's interesting to me because when I first looked on the website and heard that you were coming to town, it immediately struck me as, oh, this is puppetry, but it's not really. It's mask making and then working with that and working out pantomime. So live action body people wearing the masks
totally.
Is sort of how it is. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean it is mask. It's not specifically puppetry, but it's kind of related. It's kind of like full body puppetry in a way. I can see the connection there for sure.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, as you say, it's a mask, so it's a non-moving kind of one expression representation that's worn on a person's who's full body, and so how does that work into how the performance happens? Do you feel like because I could see a way where putting a mask on like that makes a character one-dimensional.
That is actually, it's a great question, because the thing about this form and these masks that's most striking when people come to see the show is that the masks actually really do seem to come to life. It's this crazy thing that people are always very surprised by, but that's like the number one comment we get after the show is that people are like, oh my gosh, it really did come to life. And I saw the mask have all these different expressions, and that's sort of the magic of this form. So you'd think it wouldn't happen. It is a static face. But through physicality and through how the masks are sculpted and all of that, it's this magical thing that you really have to see to believe.
Yeah, because the masks really are kind of what I see on the website, and I haven't seen you perform live, but on the website, it's an exaggerated emotion that's expressed on many of the masks. You know, so one, it looks very angry or stupefied or, you know, these different kind of things. And I would imagine that as characters get introduced in a scene, that's the first emotion that you want people to pick up on.
Totally,
so
yeah.
How do you then create other emotions, even though this one angry emotion is being represented on a mask?
Well, it has a lot to do with our physicality as actors, and that's part of the reason we love this form, is that I think people don't always realize how much of a story their body is telling. So even if the expression on the face is one thing, the physicality, the thing that your body is doing is expressing a lot too. And that's a lot of what we work with. And also the masks themselves, they do seem to have one expression, and it's definitely that, like, that first striking expression is sort of the base of that character. But there's a lot of hidden expressions in the masks too. So sort of depending on the angle that we play with and what the audience sees, a lot of expressions come through in the end.
So tell me what goes into making these masks. On your website it says an average of 50 hours, even up to 80 hours a mask. What is going on? What are you doing?
I know, it's a long process for sure. And I'm the mask maker for the company, so I spend a lot of time in the mask studio creating the characters for our shows. And and it's a long process because there's quite a few steps involved. There's the sculpting in clay of the face, and then there's making a mold, and then there's paper mache. The masks are made out of paper mache, and that's quite an investment of time. And then the painting and adding the hair and all of those things. So yeah, when all is said and done, it's quite a long process.
I recommend going on the website and seeing the 2 minutes time elapse of you working for 50 to 80 hours and building a mask. It's fascinating to see it all come to life and happen. So you make the mask, but then you're also a performer. So do you feel like being the mask maker gives you an extra insight into the personality that the mask can have, or do you talk about that with the other performers?
Definitely. I mean, one fun thing about this form is that because it's a full face mask and it covers the whole body, we actually try to not decide who's going to play what character until we have the masks, because everybody brings a little something different to the mask. So I try not to think about who I'll be playing while I'm making the masks. But definitely the fact that I'm a mask maker and performer helps inform how I make the masks. I think I have an understanding of how the masks can be used, and that helps inform how I create them as I'm sculpting and building.
Yeah, and then do you have different styles of masks?
Yeah, I mean, the masks in our shows are all sort of in a similar style, but we also teach some workshops and things like that, and we have different styles of masks for those. Some emotion masks, and also something called larval masks, which is something that we all trained with at the physical theater school that we went to.
What's that? Larval masks. I like the sound of it. It sounds disgusting.
Yeah, larval mask. It's sort of like, it's kind of like what comes before the masks we use in our shows, because the masks in our shows are quite defined characters. They're very specific. Larval masks are much less specific. They're sort of these large, white, amorphous shapes, and they're basically a tool that we use in physical theater training to learn about that, what I was speaking about before, how to use our bodies and express ourselves physically. So we also have a set of those that we teach with.
So are there sort of basics? Like, I can imagine, okay, a mask with a furrowed brow, if you lean forward he's angry, if you tilt his head he's quizzical. Are there sort of basics behind the physicality of masks and how you express different emotions?
Totally. You really nailed it. As far as like, if you have a furrowed brow and you lean forward, that can create a sense of maybe anger that the audience sees. And then our job as the performers is to really come to understand the mask and to know that with this particular mask, when I lean forward, the audience sees anger, and I can emphasize that with my body, or I can play against that with my body and create a different expression. And that's really the palette that we work with as performers.
Is it easier to work with a mask that is more amorphous rather than, because many of your masks, especially like the one that you do on the time lapse of the little girl with the teeth kind of showing, that's a very realistic looking mask to me, you know. I mean it's obviously cartoonish, but it's quite realistic, quite detailed, and that would seem to me like that might be harder to adjust for different emotions, for different things in a scene, because it's so well expressed already and so realistic. Is that harder to play with than one that's more amorphous?
It can be, yeah. It can be harder to find the nuances if it's a very extreme expression. But that being said, you'd actually be surprised at how many nuances can be found, even in a mask with that extreme of a face. So, yeah, there's in another one of our shows, I play like a middle-aged man who's quite fearful, and the expression on the mask is very strong, very wide-eyed and fearful, but we discovered that he's actually capable of having a big smile and joy, and yeah, it's there's a lot of nuance in all the masks, which is really fun to play with.
Well, Kate, how did you get into this? It seems like it's two different worlds in a way. There's a performance part of it, a physicality and performance part, and then you're a sculptor as well. I mean, and an accomplished sculptor, just judging by what I've seen of the mask. So, how did those two worlds kind of come together for you?
Well, as far as being a sculptor, it's something that I've always done more as a hobby as I grew up. I loved making things with my hands and sculpting faces and things like that in various mediums. And then that sort of came together with my performing and my theater career. Basically, once I went to school at I went to a school called Dell'Arte International School of Physical Theater, and that's really where all of us Wonderheads met, was at this physical theater school in Northern California. And this is a school that trains its students in physical theater, things like mask, also clown and other physical theater forms. And also the other main focus there is devising, like creating your own work from the ground up. So it was really there that I learned that I could be all of those things. I could create my own work and be a mask maker and a performer, and all of those things sort of come together in the work of this company, which is so awesome.
Yeah, well, that's great. It's really inspiring. You know, it's such a cool message that you can take all these different things and somehow find a common thread among them, and then all of a sudden there you go, you've created something new and interesting. That's an exciting thing to think about. So you said you're co-head. Who are the other heads?
Well, the other heads are Andrew Phoenix is the other co-head, and he and I founded the company together, and we're also married. And then the other heads are Emily Windler. She's a performer in the show as well, and she also helped create this particular show. And then Anthony Arnesta is a head as well, and he, in this particular show, he runs our tech and our sound and lights and everything.
All right, very cool. Well, it's all happening here in Juneau. We get the privilege of seeing this. It's happening Monday night, 7 p.m. It's at the JDHS, and you can get tickets through the Arts Council at jahc.org. It's Wonderheads. I definitely recommend going on the website, wonderheads.com, and checking out the beautiful and amazing and weird and cool and curious works of Kate Braidwood, who's on the phone with me. Kate, thanks so much for taking some time. And I know you're in Petersburg today, is that right?
Yeah, we're in Petersburg today, and next up is Juneau, so we're looking forward to it.
Southeast tour, very good. We're going to be glad to have you up here, and look forward to seeing you perform on Monday. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And we're now joined by Tom Looker and Heather Mitchell, who are here to talk about the Juneau Cabaret. Life's a Cabaret, and it's happening Sunday. That's this Sunday at 7 p.m. at the Rockwell Ballroom. Tom and Heather, thanks so much for coming.
Hey, Andy, thanks so much for having us on the air.
So this is, you were just saying, Tom, 9 different singers.
Mm-hmm. Our 24th show. We've been doing this since 2009 already.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
24 shows since 2009. That's a lot of shows to pack in.
Well, thanks in large measure to Laura Haywood, our producer for many years, and now executive director of the Juneau Symphony, and she has fewer hours to put toward Juneau Cabaret, so it's kind of Heather and me this time.
Yeah.
And Tom Melville's been helping out, too, with some publicity and posters, and that's been great.
Very cool, yeah.
So we have a great lineup for everyone who's going to come and listen on Sunday, March 20th, 7 p.m. at Rockwell Ballroom. The show is always pay as you can. There's no suggested donation. Just come in and experience Juneau Cabaret. 9 singers are all great local singers, women and men. Heather, of course, Heather Mitchell, who's here in the studio with us. Bobby Mitchell, who's no relation, but also a perennial favorite at Juneau Cabaret. John Haywood, who's been there since the very first show. Rhonda Jackson Bear, who's very good. Dan Wayne and Kylan Maker. Jack Brandt. Dara Relatos, and Alyssa Fisher. And what's really great this time is both Dara and Dan Wayne are originally from Wrangell. So Wrangell will be well represented
on
the stage.
The Wrangell musical experience.
Yeah. Wrangell in the house.
Yeah.
Nice.
And some great accompanists, too. Jackie Farnsworth, Missouri Smythe, Luke Weld, and we're so pleased to have David Shakely with us again on the drum kit.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say accompanist, more than just a piano.
Just piano.
Oh, just piano. Well,
we take turns.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so I'm going to accompany some of the singers.
I see.
Jackie, Missouri, Luke.
Yeah. Great, yeah. Great, gotcha. Yeah. And can I ask which number you're doing?
Ah.
Is that not to be revealed? Or?
No. Okay. It's okay. Sometimes I hold those out
yeah.
for surprises, but this time it's fine. I'm doing two songs. I'm doing two songs from the 30s. Tom will tell you a little bit about kind of what our general philosophy is in terms of song choices for these shows. But I picked two songs from the 30s. One of them is called For All We Know. And it's a song I've loved for a very, very long time and I've never sung.
I think it's a torchy ballad.
It is. It's a torchy ballad. Tomorrow may never come, so
yeah.
let's embrace now that
right.
kind of a song.
Yes.
The other
may care. Throw
yes,
it, yes.
yes. And then the other one is a kind of a smoky, kind of a swingy version of a song called You're Getting to Be a Habit with Me. And that is from an old movie musical called 42nd Street, which was turned into a musical in the 80s, which is one of the first musicals I ever saw as a teenager. I actually went to an audition for that one for the chorus, and I was 14 and I was a dancer and I was apparently not developed enough
yes.
for the chorus line. So
no callback that time?
I did not get called back. They said, grow a little and come back and see us.
Well, that's a learning experience.
So. It was. So I thought it'd be kind of a nice homage to some things that I enjoyed from when I was much younger and now I can be able to sing them as an adult.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And what is the philosophy of choosing the songs, Tom?
For Juno Cabaret, we really like to honor the Great American Songbook and all those composers who wrote popular music in America from 1920 to 1960. And we ask that each singer perform two songs and at least one of them be from the Great American Songbook or from musical theater. A lot of those overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to uphold our mission, which is preservation through performance. That's how you preserve these old tunes, is get younger people listening to them and wanting to sing them and eventually performing them. And that's the great thing about Juno Cabaret. It's all ages. Kids are welcome. We have younger people in the show, older people in the show, returning singers, people who haven't sung since they last quit in college or something. And
right.
they want to slowly get back into it. It's not a huge time commitment to
mm-hmm.
prepare just two songs, get up there, deliver them. And the great thing for the audience is the show changes every 8 or 10 minutes because there's a new singer coming on. So
mm-hmm. yeah, no, that's right. I mean, that is a fun, it's a really fun element to it.
Yeah.
And it feels like that sort of same atmosphere you would have maybe gotten in the 30s or 40s.
Exactly.
You know, there's a piano bar, that kind of thing happening. And
right.
mm-hmm.
there's some, you know, different singers at night, maybe even different piano players coming kind
exactly.
of cycling through. Yeah,
exactly.
And it's also very cool because it's a pay-as-you-can thing, which
right.
is always
mm-hmm.
a really cool thing.
Right. We welcome younger people. If they show up and they're under 21 and unaccompanied by a parent or guardian, they have to sit in a different part of the room, but they can still enjoy the show with us. And as there's no suggested donation, they can just come in and watch.
And there's beer and food. I mean,
yes.
of course.
Mm-hmm. Rockwell provides.
Rockwell also. Yeah.
Their great menu, and the bar is open. Everything's available for purchase. But again, the show is pay as you can.
And then we were talking about how cool that room is to sing in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is fun. I mean, and particularly for these types of songs, sort of a little bit of the historical, reference from that room being an old ballroom here in town. I can picture myself, you know, in my mind with my hair done in a 40s style and a 40s dress and a full orchestra behind me and everyone out dancing. And you kind of takes you back. And it is a fun room.
And then
in.
What about acoustically?
It's a great, great room.
It's a nice room.
Yeah.
For a singing
yeah.
show. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can really hear well in there.
It's got
and,
the wooden floors
yes.
and it's got some reverberation
mm-hmm.
and some echo, but
yeah.
it's also kind of directed kind of in a, you know, down the kind of down the room, so it doesn't kind of bounce all over.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a real high ceiling like a gymnasium.
Right.
And it's not like a trade show like Centennial Hall mm-hmm. either, but it's a great room for a singing show. And yeah, it is a historical room because of the territorial legislature having met there before statehood and all those things happened. And it's funny, one of the singers we had in one of the previous shows had sung in that room as a teenager 60 years before.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back when it was an Elks Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's That's sort of a cool thing about the room, really too. Cool. And a cool thing about Juno Cabaret is we've had singers as young as 15 and as old as someone who could have sung there 60 years ago.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Well, and for particularly for young people, I know my experience, I got to sing with my high school's jazz band, and that is what introduced me to a lot of this music. That and my parents. My dad made sure that I listened to some of this. But it got me into the idea that it's some really a cool set of music to listen to and then to perform. And so we want to create as many opportunities for people here. And it's a fairly low-risk proposition. You're preparing two songs. Your rehearsal demands are fairly minimal. And, of course, performance, you only have to be nervous for two songs, and then you get to enjoy everybody else singing. Yeah. So I think certainly for somebody who hasn't sung in a while or maybe has just started taking lessons in the last couple of years and is ready to move on to an actual performance setting, you know, it's like, oh, wow, I can still get my kids to everything this week and still do this show.
And then working with a, you know, professional musician like someone like Tom or Missouri who really understands not just what they have to do but also what makes a singer sound the best within the context of the song.
Exactly. They make us sound very, very good.
Yeah, and
much better than we really are,
right.
I can assure you.
I credit David Shakley with a lot of that extrasensory perception, too, that he can just walk on cold and think, okay, she's going to sing that, and we're going to carry her or him if they forget a measure or forget a lyric.
Sure.
It just continues, and it's a very safe and supportive environment for people to sing.
Well, it's the Juno Cabaret. It's happening Sunday, this March 20th, this Sunday coming up. 7 p.m. is when it happens at the Rockwell Ballroom down there in 109 Franklin Street.
Upstairs, yeah.
And it's in the upstairs, that's right. Mm-hmm. As we were just saying, it's pay as you can, so please do contribute if you can, but if you can't, don't let that hold you back.
Right, no ticket to buy, just show up, walk in. Rockwell will have food and drink available for purchase, and the music will be great.
All right. Well, Tom and Heather, thanks so much for coming in, and have a great cabaret.
Thanks, Andy.
Sounds like a great
Thank
time.
You.
Here comes Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 18th of March, 2016. It's the birthday of John Updike, born Reading, Pennsylvania, 1932. When he was 12, his aunt bought the family a subscription to The New Yorker. As a teenager, he had ambitions to make his career as a cartoonist, and when he went to Harvard, it was his cartoons that got him elected to the humor magazine The Harvard Lampoon. But he also published some poetry and prose, found that he liked writing as well. He said, "By the time I graduated, I was 85% bent upon becoming a writer. It took fewer ideas, and I seemed to be better at it, and there's less danger of smearing the ink." He joined the staff of The New Yorker, spent 2 years writing the Talk of the Town pieces. After he and his wife had a second child, they moved to Ipswich, Massachusetts, and he published his first book of poetry, his first novel, The Poor House Fair. He said of leaving New York City, "I did leave, without regret, the literary demimonde of agents and would-bes and with it non-participants. This world seemed unnutritious and interfering. I was full of a Pennsylvania thing I wanted to say, and Ipswich gave me the space in which to say it and in which to live modestly, raise my children, and have friends on the basis of what I did in person rather than what I did in print." 3 years later, he published his novel Rabbit Run, the story of Rabbit Angstrom, 26-year-old former high school basketball star who feels like his best days are behind him. Went on to write three more novels, Rabbit Redux, Rabbit is Rich, and Rabbit at Rest, and a novella, Rabbit Remembered. 1968, he had a bestseller with Couples, which landed him on the cover of Time magazine. He said of the sex scenes in Couples, "They were no harder than landscapes and a little more interesting." Updike said, "To condense from one's memories and fantasies and small discoveries dark marks on paper which become handsomely reproducible many times over still seems to me a magical act and a delightful technical process." It's the birthday of George Plimpton, New York City, 1927, author of more than 30 books, editor for 50 years of the Paris Review, who wrote what he called participatory journalism, immersing himself in whatever his subject was, usually sports, and recounting his experiences from his viewpoint as an amateur insider. It's the birthday of the poet Stéphane Mallarmé, born in Paris, 1842, who said, "It is the job of poetry to clean up our word-clogged reality by creating silences around things." And it's the birthday of Wilfred Owen, Shropshire, England, 1893, went off to fight in World War I, wrote his famous anti-war poem Dulce et Decorum Est, returned to combat, and was killed on November 4th, a week before the end of the war, at the age of 25. Here's a poem for today by Andrew Gent, entitled History. Every poem has been written before, at least 15 times. Every song, sung better. The Neanderthals discovered caves already painted with the story of their lives. They invented fire over and over again. And you and I whisper the same sweet nothings we were born with. History, a poem by Andrew Gent from Explicit Lyrics, published by the University of Arkansas Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
A night on a quest, a damsel in distress, and a vision of the world not as it is, but as it should be. All that and much more in Juno Lyric Opera's Man of La Mancha, one of the most acclaimed musicals of all time. Just three more performances at JDHS on Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2:30. Tickets on sale at Hearthside Books, The Jack, and JunoOpera.org. You won't want to miss Man of La Mancha this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at JDHS.
At the dawn of the age of electricity, a doctor has invented a way to cure people of hysteria. But what really goes on in the doctor's examining room? His wife would like to know, and wouldn't you? Come down to Perseverance Theater for an electrifying comedy and find out if this new medical device can open the hearts and minds, as well as other areas, to new possibilities. In the Next Room, where the vibrator play opens March 11th. For more information and tickets, visit ptalaska.org, The Jack, and Hearthside Books.
And I'll be down there tonight for Beer Friday at Perseverance Theater. Are you going to be there too, Damon?
No.
Not tonight?
No, I'm going to apply.
I've seen you there before, but David Suber has joined us, and Damon is the director, producer, financier, executive producer, and all other
writer,
things.
Writer, editor, yes.
Of a brand new, very cool film called Storis. It's the galloping ghost of the Alaskan coast, and it's all about this very unique Coast Guard vessel that, as you were saying, as we were just talking, kind of does a lot of mirroring the history of Alaska itself. So, first of all, tell me a little bit about the beginnings of this very unique boat.
Storis was actually built in the run-up for World War II. There was a time period where the United States feared that Nazi Germany was going to occupy Greenland, which is obviously in North America. So President Roosevelt sent a blockade of naval forces up to Greenland to keep Germany out, even before the United States entered the war. So Storis was actually built for that time period. It was actually designed to be an ice-breaking supply ship to supply the Greenland area and patrol the North Atlantic. But that was during World War II. Once it got here to Alaska in the post-war era, its career pretty much followed the history of the state of Alaska. Statehood changed its missions. It also dealt with the construction of the Dew Line, the Cold War project on the high Arctic to spot Soviet bombers coming up over the North Pole. It served as a relief ship during the 1964 earthquake. It was served as a safety ship for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline construction. It was a command ship for the cleanup of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It's like
every major sort of thing that had to do with anything on a coastline anywhere.
Yes, also in the 1960s, that was the time period when there was large fleets of Japanese and Russian fishing vessels encroaching into U.S. waters. Storrs was out there chasing those ships down, and actually became the ship that actually had the first law enforcement seizures in Alaska.
Wow. And you were saying, so the one of the things that's interesting about it is that it's got a 65-year history. That seems like a long time for a boat to be commissioned.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what was interesting for me was the ship was a prototype. It was the only ship designed of its class. When Storrs was built, it was built for a very specific purpose. When it was completed, the United States was very heavily involved in the war, so its needs changed. And of course, because of that, Storrs became the only ship of its design. And to me, that was an amazing, amazing fact that was in service for 65 years.
And when was it decommissioned?
It was decommissioned in 2007 in Kodiak.
And is it dismantled now, or where is it now?
The sad part about the Storrs is Storrs was sold for scrap in 2013. So Storrs has been disassembled.
Is no more.
Yes.
Well, as many things, they have long vital lives, and then they are yes. no longer of the temporal earth. So tell me a little bit about what got you so interested in this. Are you a person that is on boats all the time and stuff like that? Or
no, yeah, but okay. I do like history. I really do like history. This all kind of started one snowy evening when someone that I know, who is a very well-respected Alaskan historian, approached me and said that he was working with a group of people trying to save the Storrs and convert it into a maritime museum. And my first reaction, I will be the first one to admit, was no, I don't have the time to do it. I just bought a house at the time. And he kept persisting and persisting, and finally I relented and I said, okay, I'll look at the ship's history just to see what's there. And I was really quite surprised on how massive the ship's history was, how voluminous its missions were. And I have to admit, and I've been joking about this, my master bathroom is still not done. but I have a
was
documentary.
Given over to the store. Yes, you have a DVD to show for it. Just put those in the bathroom, and you'll be fine. And tell me a little bit about actually producing this. As I was reading through some of the credits on the back of the DVD, it's a who's who of notable Juno voices and Juno talent as well.
Yes, Rob Cohen did the music. Without him, The music is absolutely beautiful, and it fits the mood for the various scenes of the documentary. Dave Hunsiger volunteered.
Deep voice today.
Yes, deep voice. He volunteered to be my narrator.
Very cool.
I have a couple voiceovers. As with all historical documentaries, you have voiceovers of people reading historical documents. Aaron Elmore. Pat Race, John Greeley, Dave Donaldson, who I often call him Mr. President because he voices a telegram of President Eisenhower.
Very good, as only Dave Donaldson can. Well, it sounds like you've got a great crew there behind it. Tell me what's going on. Is there more about this? Is there a showing of the film or anything
yes.
like that going to be happening?
Yes, okay. the documentary will be screening this coming weekend at Gold Town Nickelodeon. It's on Sunday, March 20th at 4:30 in the afternoon, and again on Monday, the 21st at 7 p.m. And then the following weekend, the following week, on Swords Day, Monday, the 28th, we'll be screening it at 4:30 and 7.
Well, that's great. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
This is such a cool thing to hold this and sort of say, wow, this is a completed project. You did it.
Yes, right? it was a long time coming.
You are a movie maker. And it's, once again, Storrs, the galloping ghost of the Alaskan coast. It's all about this very unique ship of the Coast Guard a very unique cutter, but as you said, a one-of-its-kind design cutter operated for 65 years in Alaskan waters. And the story of it and the story of trying to maybe save it or not maybe is part of the story as well. Okay,
yes,
very
it is.
Good. Okay. And so if you want to see that, obviously it's available in DVD, but if you want to see it up on the big screen, it's going to be playing at the Gold Town this Sunday at 4:30 and Monday at 7 p.m. and also going to be playing next week as well. And Gold Town Nickelodeon has other times where people can find out about it. Damon, congratulations. It's awesome to see this.
Thank you, Andy.
And have a great screening of Storrs. It's happening Sunday at 4:30 and Monday at 7 p.m. Gold Town Nickelodeon. Damon, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Andy.
Okay, right now here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Hear those chicks calling? They're nestlings at a great blue heron colony, and about this time of year, they begin to test the limits of their nests. Imagine a structure made out of sticks and twigs supporting vigorous offspring 40 feet high in a swaying tree. That's what the adults had to construct during late winter and early spring. It was the male that found and brought the sticks, and the female who decided what went where. First, she had to wedge a strong stick near the main branch of a large cottonwood or fir tree. With that one stick in place, and the second and the third, she then wove more flexible twigs into the sturdy base. When the last of four or five eggs was laid, the pair took turns incubating them for 28 days. The chicks we're hearing didn't get eaten by an eagle, hawk, or crow, so they've spent 2 months growing to full adult size. That's 48 inches, with wings that stretch some 6 feet wide. Ah, music to a heron parent's ears. Without blueprints, architects, or engineers, they created the young heron's first home. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Support for programming comes from AGP Wealth Advisors, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., offering retirement planning and investment advice for Alaska State employees. More information at agpwealthadvisors.com.
Support comes from Treadwell Ice Arena, offering a youth hockey clinic on March 17th and March 22nd from 5:30 until 6:30 p.m. and April 3rd from 1:30 until 2:30 p.m. No experience is necessary and all abilities are welcome. Those interested are encouraged to sign up early. Helmets, breezers, elbow pads, gloves, shin guards, sticks, and jerseys are all available and offered on a first-come, first-served basis. More information at 586-0410.
And welcome back to the KTO studios. I'm Andy Klein, and I'm joined right now by Winston Smith, who's here to talk about World Youth Day, a benefit for World Youth Day. Hi, Winston.
Hi there.
How you doing?
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit about what's going to be happening.
Well, you know, World Youth Day is an annual event. It's a Catholic-sponsored event where young teens gather every year at a location. Last year was Buenos Aires. This year it's in Krakow, Poland. And it's just a wonderful experience. It's a week-long experience. This year is the last week of July, first part of August. And they all gather and, you know, learn a little bit about other people's cultures and, you know, and obviously it's a faith-based gathering. But it's a wonderful place for kids to go and learn about other people and become good global citizens. And so we, Earth and Vessel, we're a ministry, music ministry from Juneau, been together probably over a decade. And we've been invited to put together a couple of musical events, musical services. One is tomorrow evening at St. Anne's Hall downtown on Fifth Street from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And the admission is free, and obviously there'll be donations taken, and there'll be there'll be refreshments and things like that for people to buy. And the music is it's inspirational, and it's not just a concert. Really, we invite people to come and join in singing with us, and it's a wonderful service. And we're going to do it again on April 2nd at St. Paul's Catholic Church in the Valley off of Atlin.
And then all the donations and all the funds that are raised for this go towards Juno kids being able to travel. Is that right?
Right, right. And not just Juno, the Diocese of Juno, which includes Southeast. So there may be some teens from Haines or other parts of Southeast Alaska, Sitka or whatever. But yes, everything raised goes to help the expenses, the travel expenses of what we call the pilgrims, the teens that are traveling.
How many teens are there estimated?
I don't know really exactly how many we've had this year, but we've had probably as many as 15, 20 in the past, and maybe even more. But
wow,
yeah, in some cases, obviously, it's limited by resources that are available, because it's fairly costly. It's several thousand dollars to travel, in this case, to Krakow. But it's but literally, tens of thousands of teens gather at these things, and it's a week-long event. It's a life-changing experience.
Have you been to one of them?
I've not had the privilege to attend one. There are.
I mean, you're not a teen.
But there are adults. there are adults that are quote chaperones
yeah,
kind of
right.
thing that goes
sure.
that. And although I'd love to go, I've not had the opportunity to go. But I've heard great things about it, and I'm just excited to be a part of trying to support what I think is just a wonderful experience for these for these young teens.
So let's just go over it one more time. So it's Earth and Vessel, and that's kind of the musical group that has this musical services that they
do.
March 19th at 7, from 7 to 8:30 at St. Anne's Hall, and that's next to the Cathedral of the Nativity Catholic Church on 5th Street.
Right.
And once again, it's to benefit the youth of the Diocese of Juneau attending this World Youth Day 2016, and then you said there's also an April 2nd performance
right.
as well.
Right, same type of event, trying to take advantage of people who might not be able to make it downtown over at a little larger venue at St. Paul's.
That's great.
And so we're going to do it again. So try to generate as much interest and get as many people to come. And like I said, admission's free. So just come join us and have a great time with us.
All right. Well, it sounds great. That's, once again, World Youth Day Benefit. It's happening Saturday. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. at St. Anne's Hall. And it's all to help the youth attend this faith-based World Youth Day 2016.
Great.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Winston.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming in.
Okay. You bet.
And that's a Juno afternoon for this Friday. Thanks to all my guests for coming in. Wanted to mention the event happening at the Yacht Club Saturday that was scheduled has been canceled. Playboy Spaceman had to cancel, so the KXLL benefit is not happening. So hopefully everyone is getting the message about that. And thanks to all my guests that came in and attend that fireside lecture tonight at 6:30 or 8. The Wonderheads are coming in on Monday. The cabaret is on Sunday, as well as the screening for the Storrs is on Sunday, and the World Youth Benefit is happening tomorrow at 7 p.m. That's it for a Juno afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. Thanks so much for listening. Coming up next is All Things Considered.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210 AM in Gustavus,